Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Welcome everyone who's come for this afternoon's webcast and Dhamma reflections here at Amravati and around the country, around the world. So I'll begin with offering a few reflections as usual, and then respond to the questions that have come in during the during this week. Firstly, I'd like to acknowledge the great deal of activity, protest around the world, particularly in the USA and here in the United Kingdom, on the continent of Europe and in Australia, around the world, with respect to the death, the murder of George Floyd in America as being the trigger or the spark that has launched this wave of protests, and the people taking to the streets in very large numbers. I believe every state in the USA, they've had protests or having protests right now. And more than 400 towns and cities in the USA where people are making their voices heard, and largely in peaceful and non-violent ways. And I feel this is along with the epidemic of the coronavirus that is affecting, touching everybody's lives, then this is also, bringing to light or really bringing home the other issues in our world that are very active, have a big influence, and I feel it's very important to be concerned about the issues of racism and social inequality, the way that various sectors of society around the world, in the USA or in this country and in most countries in various ways around the world, there are sectors of the population that are downtrodden, disadvantaged, and the kind of hopelessness or painfulness of those conditions are very much a matter of our concern, and that the Buddha's teaching also helps us to cultivate a skillful attitude of how to work with these kind of conditions as best we can. I feel it's quite appropriate and suitable to step up and say, you know, that when we experience injustice or things being unfair, people being improperly treated, then it's quite appropriate to speak up and to address that. I feel this is the good heart. As human beings, we have these qualities of what's called guna dhamma, or the natural virtue of the heart, which I feel is what is mostly at play, what's really being drawn upon at this time, that this is that sense of the good, the sense of what is right, what is noble, what is beautiful. So the sense of that which calls for justice or for fairness or for kindness, for compassion, for equality, is coming from that good heart of ours as human beings. And I feel it's that good heart that's crying out very strongly through this country and the USA and around the world in particular, with respect to this the tragedy of George Floyd's death, but not just him alone, but many, many others, countless others who have been harmed or died and had their lives made a misery on account of the color of their skin or their social status and the pressures of societies around the world that have, cause people to be disadvantaged or to be, looked upon as lesser or inferior. In the Buddha's own time, he made great efforts to work against the caste system. One of the most, significant sections of his teachings in the Dhammapada, he goes into a great detail, a long and beautiful, thorough exposition of what is a true Brahmin, what is a true spiritual person, what is a truly good or pure person. And over again, he makes the point that one is not a Brahmin by one's birth or one's skin color or by ritual, but rather what makes one a true Brahmin, a truly good person or a pure person, a noble person, is the qualities of the heart. It's one's actions, one's attitudes, inner virtue, that guna dhamma, that is what makes a true, noble or pure or good person. So I feel these are the voices that are being raised around the world are very much in accord with the Buddha's own voice, trying to work against those destructive and uncaring, selfish qualities that can so easily overtake our human society and have a large negative influence on us, that can hold various sections of the population down in unprivileged positions. Also, I'm aware of speaking as a sort of white male with an educated background, and so that I can't, in many respects, speak from direct experience of growing up or living in that kind of condition of oppression. But I, to the degree that I can, I try to educate myself and have a quality of sympathy and care for that condition in our world, and the people who have, been living with that for their whole lifetimes, their families and everyone around them, their whole community, their lives very deeply and directly affected in that way, even to the point of losing your life, to having your life taken away from you simply because of the color of your skin or your social status, your place in society. And so I feel that when we look at this, rather than making ourselves just stressed or anxious or helpless, I feel one of the things that we can do is to consider, well, how can we make a difference? What can we do? What is there within our power to be of assistance? And I feel that to essentially be part of the solution rather than part of the problem, to be looking at those attitudes in our own mind which are biased, which are taking things for granted, which are the assumptions of privilege that we might have, the way we judge each other, the way that we put other people down, even in small ways, just to look at that. How do we alienate ourselves from each other? And the I feel also the degree to which we can learn to work with our differences of opinion, our differences of perspective, to relate to each other in unselfish ways, to commit the heart to nonviolence, not just in physical action, but also nonviolence in speech. Can we really speak to each other from that place of the good heart? Can we speak to each other with words that are kindly, that are well-informed, that are inclined towards benefit? Or do we attack each other? The Buddha uses this language of, wounding each other with verbal daggers. Can we rather not do that? Can we instead choose words where we can express our opinion, we can offer our perspective from a place of respect, of kindness, of harmlessness? Can we listen to others without judging them or finding fault, but can we receive their who they are and their perspective, their point of view? Can we really receive that into our hearts? Because I feel that one of the great things, the blessings that we have with the human life, regardless of our immediate resources, is that we can call upon that quality of goodness. We can choose to relate from a place of unselfishness. We can choose to be nonviolent. We can choose to be kindly, to be compassionate, to be wise moment by moment. And even in the small interactions that we have during the course of a day, then that is, is a contribution to the quality of well-being, the quality of peace, the quality of, benefit. And then the degree to which we're interacting with a larger society, the effect we can have on our families or the world around us, the way we can, bring our voice into the mix to help to help others in a more broad way or a more sort of socially interactive way. Similarly, if we're speaking from a place of truth, a place of unselfishness, a place of genuine compassion and wisdom, and out of respectfulness for those to whom we're speaking and those about whom we're speaking, then that is contributing something, contributing in a genuine, maybe just a small way, but in a genuine way to helping us to work together as a human family, to learn how to get along. And I feel the Buddha's teaching is extremely well crafted in order to help, look beyond the surface of things, look beyond the kind of superficial images, and to reach beyond that. He just says, throughout his career, as I was saying, he was working against the prejudice of the caste system, the way that we judge each other according to our birth, our social status, our skin color, our background, and to not be going along with that, but to be able to speak with respect and sincerity to whoever. There's a famous occasion where the Buddha was invited to give a teaching in a country town, and all people had gathered and they were waiting, and the Buddha wouldn't start speaking, and one of the village elders said, "Well, Venerable Sir, we're all gathered here. You know, this is a time to give a Dhamma teaching." And the Buddha said, "I won't speak until the last person who's coming will arrive, because he'll be of it'll be a benefit to him. It'll be of special significance to this person." And it was a farmer who he'd lost one of his cattle. One of his cows had escaped, and he'd been rounding up and sort of recovering his lost cow. And he was not able to get to the gathering on time. The Buddha waited till the farmer had arrived. And even after he'd arrived, the people said to him, "Well, Venerable Sir, the man has arrived. You can give your talk now." And the Buddha said, "Well, I think he's tired and hungry. Give him something to eat. Let him recover, and then I'll start speaking." So that the Buddha, who was from a warrior noble background, from the Himalayas, from Nepal, he was a sort of warrior noble caste person, And yet, that was of absolutely no significance that the village headman had spoken to him, and all the important people of the village are here. The Buddha said, "No, there's this farmer hasn't arrived yet." So that to the Buddha, the fact that this person would benefit from the teaching was as equally important, if not more important, than the other sort of heads of the village and the sort of senior people in the group had already shown up. And then, sure enough, when the Buddha gave this teaching, then that farmer realized stream entry. So the Buddha was seeing that spiritual quality, regardless of the fact that the person was a farmer, probably completely illiterate and uneducated, is completely insignificant. His human heart, his noble heart, was the thing that was of importance. And so the Buddha really spoke to that. So in a way, that poor farmer was regarded as someone who was as equally important, and someone that should be waited for, should be respected, and that the Buddha would hold up the assembly in order for him to arrive. And I feel that's a very beautiful and it's a wonderful example that status is just a joke. There's nothing there really. It doesn't really matter from one respect. It's not a joke in terms of those who are on the receiving end of other people's privilege and people using their status to take advantage of others. Then it's very far from a joke. But in its essence, these are just human agreements. They're just social structures. There's no thing really there. And I feel the Buddha's teaching was based very much on that understanding, that recognition that these kinds of social status and position, these are not anything that are of fundamental importance or significance. What really matters is the good heart. What really matters is our nature as human beings. And I feel that during this time, the more that we can appreciate that and we can understand our own biases, our own, ways our perceptions might be affected or loaded because of our background, our education, our conditioning, the more that we'll be able to, really hear each other and to respect each other, to work together, and by encouraging that quality of goodness, that guna dhamma, that quality of the good heart within ourselves, and relating to that in others, seeing that in others, and putting aside all concerns of their nationality or their gender, their age, their sexual orientation, their skin color, and so on and so forth, that then we can really flourish as a human family, and that we can use the Buddha's teachings, other spiritual teachings to encourage qualities to really support human goodness. And that'll be of great benefit, not just to ourselves, but to everyone that our life touches. So to go to today's collection of questions, they're quite varied. And the first, I'll do the first two together because they're kind of the same issue. So the first one is, when painful feelings are too overwhelming, what would be the approach to overcome them? And then the partner question to that is, Dear Ajahn Amaro, could you give some advice on how to work with pain during meditation? I'm not speaking about posture pains or the like triggered by the meditation posture, but rather like continuous back pain or tooth pain. Rephrasing my question, can meditation help minimize those kinds of pain, even chronic ones, and what would be the procedure? I tried finding material within your literature and videos, also by Ajahn Sumedho or Ajahn Chah, but couldn't really find something. Could you also point me to a talk or a book that might be helpful to go deeper in this area? Thank you for all the support the Amravati Sangha is giving to us in our common journey. Well, there are a few things come to mind with respect to this, very common questions. all of our bodies experience pain, some more continuously than others. There is a few places in the teachings where the subject is about reducing painful feelings, as advice given to Anatta Pindika, who's one of the great lay disciples of the Buddha, the one who donated the Jeta Grove to the Buddha to be a monastery. When he is quite sickly and in a lot of pain, then Venerable Sariputta goes to visit him with Venerable Ananda along as well, and Sariputta gives him a lot of good advice. But it's almost always the case that rather than the aim being the absence of physical pain, the aim is right understanding, is right view, and the change of heart towards those physical pains. So I feel that, I can, again, I don't have the experience of chronic physical pain that might come anytime, might come today, for the rest of my life, but I don't know. But I can't speak from direct experience of having a continuous chronic pain in my life, and in this lifetime at least. So I can only really use the examples of the people around me and what we have in the Buddha's teaching. The Buddha himself had chronic pain when he was elderly. In the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, the discourse on the Buddha's last days, Sutta number 16 in the Digha Nikaya, the long discourses, he makes a point of mentioning that he is now 80 years old. He said, my body is like an old cart held together with straps and strings, it's like an old worn down vehicle. He said, there's no posture in which I can be where the body is free of pain. So he's saying right there that he is experiencing chronic pain. And he said, the only way I can experience relief from that pain is to absorb the mind into emptiness, to dwell in the sunyata vihara. So that there's a particular kind of meditation, this meditation on emptiness, and a concentration of the mind that where it's able to disconnect from physical feeling. And the Buddha says that's the only way he can feel comfort, is to, in a sense, disconnect his attention from the sense world. If he's paying attention to the body, then it's painful. So, but he doesn't praise that sunyata vihara is like, therefore that's the goal, but rather if he wants a relief, or if there's a time to take some relief from physical pain, that's how he does it. But he doesn't praise that as a goal in and of itself, and I feel that's a helpful teaching in its own right. That if we're looking for the end of suffering, the end of dukkha, that is talked about in the Four Noble Truths, that's really not just about physical pain. It's not about bringing the uncomfortable feelings or chronic pain of the back or wherever it might be, bringing that to an end, but rather the ending of dukkha, the ending of suffering that's there in the Four Noble Truths, is really the suffering of what the mind adds. It's the dukkha of the feeling of wrongness. It shouldn't be this way. So one of the most frequently quoted teachings, and is say it's a short teaching but extremely useful, that is say I find I quote very, very often, is called the Arrow, the Salla Sutta, and it's found in the Sanyutta Nikaya, the collection of connected discourses, connected by theme, and it's about the feelings of pain. And the Buddha uses the image of a soldier shot on the battlefield. And so he says that because the body is alive, we have physical sensations. And so that a soldier shot on the battlefield, they feel physical pain. And so this is an example of our life, that we have a body, we have a mind. Therefore, physical pain is inescapable. I said, no one can escape being hit by that first arrow. The second arrow, that is everything that the mind adds to that physical pain, the feeling of resentment, of waiting for it to be over, of negotiating with it, of feeling unfairness, it shouldn't be this way, why me, this is something has gone wrong, this is out of order. So he says that second arrow can be avoided, and so that, I feel, is a very... a crucial teaching. And it's interesting how much in the world nowadays of mindfulness meditation, and also dealing with chronic pain by neuroscientists and people who are pain specialists, this teaching is becoming more and more well known and widespread and understood, that it's so much the attitude towards the pain that is the area where we can really make a difference. To physically reduce the pain is one thing, but to change the attitude towards it is another. And that's where we can really have the most crucial effect. But also, it's not just in that one comment in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta where the Buddha makes that, but numerous times he'll say, he's giving a Dhamma talk, and he'll turn to Venerable Sariputta and say, Sariputta, the assembly is still wide awake, my back is paining me, I'm going to go and lie down, I'm going to stretch my back, please carry on giving a Dhamma talk because everybody's still wide awake and wants to listen to more teachings. Or it says, it describes him sitting in a Dhamma hall, leaning against a pillar at the center of the hall to rest his back as he's giving a teaching. So that that chronic back pain is something that was apparent, and numerous times it's mentioned during that period of the Buddha's life. Another time where he's sitting on the porch, the veranda of his kuti, warming his back in the evening sun, just to get some relief, some ease from the sun's rays as a sort of heat lamp, to try and reduce the aches and pains of his back, with Ananda sitting next to him and commenting how what an impact old age is having on the Buddha. So one of the teachings, so then that is provided along with that teaching of the second arrow, is, well, how do we go about avoiding that? And so another teaching that's related to that is where a disciple of the Buddha called Nakulapita, who's very old, he's according to the commentaries of that, I think he's 100 years old or so at the time. So very aged and quite decrepit, and goes to the Buddha and said, "I'm really really old, and my body is really run down. I'm very sickly and full of pain. You know, what can I do to work with this ongoing condition?" And the Buddha says it's much better to be afflicted in body and not afflicted in mind, rather than to be afflicted in mind and not afflicted in the body. And so that kind of sets the sort of attitudinal framework for that, that we might look towards happiness coming from a body which is free of pain, and so much of our life and our efforts are geared towards that. But what's more important is what's your mind doing with it. Because most people are aware, you can have a very comfortable body, you can have a very privileged existence in many respects, have all the comforts of home and all the freedoms you could wish for, and still feel completely miserable and imprisoned, even when you, without the lockdown procedure or without your limitations of a human life, you can still feel trapped, you can still be miserable with no physical pain whatsoever. It's one of the other tragedies of our human society is that the levels of alcoholism, suicide, and drug abuse are generally much higher in comfortable countries. So that countries that have got a lot of social cohesion and a lot of resources, often the levels of depression, alcoholism, suicide are much, much higher. So even when everything is comfy, yeah, then we can still make ourselves miserable. So this teaching on the two arrows, I feel, is extremely significant. It's not just about physical pain, but rather what is our mind doing with this moment? How are we relating to this particular experience of difficulty or wrongness? So the advice that the Buddha gives to Nakulapita is essentially the same discourse that he gave to the five companions of his just after his enlightenment, called the Anattalakkhana Sutta, the discourse on not self. So with Nakulapita, he says he goes through the five khandhas, the body, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, consciousness. And with each of those, he says, the body, is it changing? Yes, it's changing. Is that which is changing, can that be, is that afflicted or is that free from affliction? What's the experience if the body's in a state of change? Then Nakulapita says, well, the body is in a state of affliction. It's not free from affliction because it's constantly changing. If it's comfortable, you can't hang on to that comfort for any amount of time. And so then the Buddha says, well, if something is changing, is subject to affliction, is it appropriate to say of it, this is me, this is what I am, this is myself? No, Bhante. No, Hetang Bhante. So that with each of the five khandhas, with Vedana, physical sensation, feeling, with perception, Sanya, with mental formations, Sankhara, and then Vijnana, consciousness, each one he goes through in the same way with Nakulapita. So it's essentially encouraging that insight into not-self, to see the aspects of the body and the mind as, this is not me, this is not what I am, this is not mine, this is not myself. And that's the way to find comfort, to be unafflicted in mind, even if the body is afflicted. So that might not be very helpful, or you might want some more resources. I think nowadays with the amount of Dhamma literature that's available or online, you can do searches or just go to Google or Wikipedia and look for Buddhist teachings on freedom from pain, and you might find many resources. But I feel that the most helpful thing is not seeking for happiness through ending the pain, but seeking happiness through changing the attitude. And I feel that those are the most viable and helpful and genuinely beneficial avenues of approach to chronic pain. Again, I'm speaking from a position of not feeling that, not having that in my own life, so I can't speak from direct experience, but those people that I know who have chronic pain and that have that from decades of arthritis, joint pain or injuries, say, unrelenting headaches, like Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi has had these crushing headaches for years and years, decades, he's had to work with it. He's one of the most eminent Buddhist practitioners and scholars in the world, and yet he deals with chronic pain on a daily basis. It's essentially unrelenting. So that if you wish to find any further resources, if you look for, I'm not sure who asked this question, but if you seek out Bhikkhu Bodhi and his writings, his teachings, you might well find some very well-informed and direct insight into chronic pain on account of that. So the second question. Dear Ajahn, I hope everyone at Amravati is well and that you have everything you need. Certainly good enough. Everything is good enough. Could you give your thoughts on the following, please? Is it of benefit to stay with one particular meditation object for many sittings, say for a few weeks, or rather pick a new one at every sitting depending on your mood? The usual response, this is a very common question, the usual way I respond to it will be to say, well, it depends on you, it depends on the person. You know, some of us say can find a great deal of benefit and of, say, great practicality in having a variety of things, to be using a variety of methods, to, say, even combine meditation methods. For some people, that kind of multiplicity is very comfortable. It works very easily, it's very natural, and has beneficial results. For other people, it becomes a source of confusion, or they find themselves, it just feeds the quality of restlessness. It's not very beneficial. They're always sort of dwelling on the idea, or maybe this one's better, maybe this one, maybe this one, maybe this one. So that there's a very unhelpful results from that. So the two things I would say with respect to this question is, what's your own character? What do you benefit from? What is, say, your own sort of personality, say, inclined towards? If you look at your life, and so one of the qualities of a well-rounded person, to someone who is, say, has developed mindfulness and full awareness, sati and sampajanya, someone who is, well-grounded or well-experienced in spiritual qualities, one of the aspects of that is knowing yourself, atanyata, knowing your own personality. So for some people, that they benefit much better from just say, okay, this is what I'm going to do, and that this is my method, I take this approach, and I don't have to think about anything else, just park that. And that quality of just sticking to one thing, parking everything else, at least for an extended period of time, then they say, well, that really benefits, that kind of commitment, that sense of following a set pattern, makes things very simple, makes it very clear. Okay, that's what we're doing. We're on board this train. Okay, don't think about where else you might be going. This is what I'm doing for now. So, to get to know or to explore your own character, to see what is, say, a good fit for the way your mind likes to work, and then use that, so that the that I would say is the first part of it, is to get to know your own character, and then the second part is I've mentioned a little bit already, is see what the results are, using this quality of vimamsa. So if you try a particular approach, what's the results of that approach? Okay, I've been trying to stick with one thing and parking everything else. What's the result of that? Where did it go? What was the effect of that? Okay, I've been changing things around, or just choosing what I want to do day by day, or several different things in a day. What's the result of that? So you're deliberately bringing the attention to the effects of the causes that have been created. Okay, this is the way it's been done. What's the result of that? So you're using that kind of feedback, a sort of self-informed feedback, to guide what's helpful, what's beneficial. Because we might be making a choice because, you know, someone like myself, you know, in the role of an Ajahn, literally sitting in a high seat, says, you know, you should do this. So we're being obedient to what an ajahn says, or maybe it's the first instruction that you got, that you were told do it this way, so you think, well, that's how I was told to do it, so I should do it that way. And we can be very obedient or just habituated and not really be looking at the results of what we're doing. And so I feel that quality of vimamsa, which is the Buddha named as the last of the four bases of success, the iddhipada, that's the really a crucial quality to see the effects of what we do. One middle way of working with it, of this kind of mixture of approaches, is to say, okay, I'm really interested to develop more concentration, and mindfulness of breathing is certainly a highly recommended and a good enough method of approach. So just to keep things simple, for the next 2 weeks, every single meditation sitting that I do, I'll just do mindfulness of breathing and put everything else aside. For this 2 week period, keep it very simple, just do that. And then at the end of that 2 week period, then to see, okay, what was the result of that? So that you're literally sort of setting out setting out the ground. You're kind of setting out a program over a particular span of time, and then looking at what the results are. So that you are directly informing yourself as to how things work. Or you can set it up, say, okay, for this next 2 weeks or this next month, yeah, I will never have a plan. I'm far too attached to structure. I like to have a formula. I like to have a structure. I'm really attached to that. So let's just park all of the structures, and I'll ban myself from having a plan for the next month. So that whenever a plan arises, I want to do this today, I want to do that, I say, no, I'll just leave it be and see what comes to mind as I sit down and do that. So you can experiment in that way. And then again, to set out a framework like that, and then to see what the results are in due course. And then be informed by what the results are. Does your choice lead to being more uptight, more anxious? Does it lead to being more restless? Does it lead to being sleepy? Or does it lead to being awake and clear-minded? Does it conduce to the mind being focused and bright? Does it lead the mind to being tense and agitated? What's the result? We can see whether it leads to sense desire or ill will, restlessness, dullness, doubt, or whether it leads towards clarity, focus, and towards mindfulness and wisdom. Then let those results be what guide us. Next one. Venerable Ajahn, many thanks for your inspiring talks. We want to express my immense heartfelt gratitude. That's okay, much obliged. I struggle with emotions of loneliness and social isolation, as I virtually have no friends or family. Lord Buddha strongly recommended having kalyanamitas to help one stay grounded on the path. What can I do when you don't have one, or if they're not accessible? One tries to console oneself intellectually that, quote, this is impermanent and non-self, unquote, but in absence of deep penetration, gets overwhelmed because is unable to realize the ultimate truth. So my question to you, Ajahn, that how can one be a refuge unto oneself, not have any emotional dependence on another? Respects and regards. So So sorry to hear that having no friends, no family, and particularly during this time of isolation and lockdown, that's a particularly difficult situation. But if that's what one has to work with, then I feel like that teaching on the second arrow, rather than dwelling on the painfulness of one's condition, to bring the attention to what is the mind adding to it. With respect to independence, the Buddha uses that quality, independence or freedom from reliance, as a synonym for stream entry. So that I fully acknowledge that having good friends, having sahadamikas, kind of companions in the spiritual life, having say good companions is a major resource, and it is a powerful way of providing guidance and encouragement and receiving feedback and just the warmth of good friendship is very significant, and the Buddha did praise that. But if that's not available for whatever reason, then the need is to draw upon the resources of our own mind. But also, you say you have no friends, no family, but also you ask this question, and here I am talking into a camera, and hopefully the person who wrote this is watching, is listening, and so there is a sense of companionship. I'm talking right to you, so you have you have this degree of contact and friendship, and the world is able to respond to you in some way, shape, or form. But essentially, the beneficial effect of Kalyanamitta, of spiritual friends, is that the contact with spiritual friendship is what we can bring about in terms of changes of our own heart. In that teaching that the Buddha gave to Ananda, when Ananda says that Kalyanamitta is half of the holy life, if I'm remembering correctly, it's a very, very often quoted teaching. The Buddha says, "No." When Ananda comes to the Buddha and says to the Buddha, "I've heard it said that Kalyanamitta, spiritual friendship, is half of the holy life." And the Buddha responds by saying, "Don't say that, Ananda. Not so, Ananda. It's not half the holy life. It's the whole of the holy life." And so that is quite a dramatic, emphatic statement that the Buddha makes. And so you think, wow, this friendship is really important. It's a crucial thing. So, but it's not just about having like-minded people close by. As often the case, the Buddha takes an initial comment or a statement or a principle and then opens it up or sees it in different ways. And again, if I'm remembering correctly, I haven't read the text of it for some time, but he starts off by saying having good companions, having like-minded people nearby who can encourage you in goodness, can encourage you in developing noble qualities, can encourage you in developing virtue and concentration and wisdom. You know, that's extremely important. But also, Kalyanamitta is also being a mitta of the Kalyana, being a friend of the wholesome. Kalyana means wholesomeness or good. Goodness. So being a friend of your own goodness, and so he sort of, in the second part of the teaching, he flips it around and saying the Kalyanamitta is the whole of the holy life, because it's like association with the good, association with the noble. And what is the good, what is the noble? It's the Eightfold Path. So the Kalyanamitta is remembering that you have the capacity to practice the Eightfold Path every moment. There's nothing that stops us from doing that. And so it's not just spiritual friendship, but it's friendship with the spiritual. So just as our mind can dwell upon the people that we miss, that we used to have good friends in the past, or used to have a family and now we're all separated from each other, or family have died or gone away, or the people that are around me, my neighbors, they're really difficult, I don't get on with them, or I'm fighting with my people in the next apartment, and or squabbling with other family members, so there's division between us. We can easily dwell upon that external aspect of, oh, I don't have any friends who are spiritual or who are supportive. But we still have the capacity to be friendly with the spiritual. We can open the heart to the Dhamma. We cannot let the attention dwell on everything that's wrong with the people in my family, the people that are around, the people in the country, the people in the government. We can not just dwell on the wrongness or the lack in what's outside us, but we can, as a contrast or as a complement to that, we can see that this very life of ours is a vessel of the Dhamma, that the Dhamma is here and now, it can't be anywhere else. It's timeless, it's ever-present. It's within us, it's to be realized within this very life, this very heart, this very mind. The Dhamma is not anywhere else than the very fabric of your own life, your own mind. So that's always here, but we can forget that reality because of dwelling on our conflicts with other people, or the things that we want to do that we can't do, the places we want to go where we can't go, or the arguments that we're in the middle of, or the unrequited longings that we might have. We forget that inner wholeness, that kalyana of our own heart, the good heart, as it were, because of dwelling on the external aspects of it. So I feel it's a very powerful teaching, but people often forget or miss that second part of it, where the Buddha is talking about being friendly with the spiritual, association with the good. And that means remembering the Dhamma, remembering the Eightfold Path is available, that we can train the heart in skillful attitudes, skillful speech, skillful action. That we can learn to focus the mind, we can develop wisdom in every moment. So when that development is fulfilled or is moving towards fulfillment, this is what we call stream entry, or the making the breakthrough. And that independence of reliance is where the attitude changes, where the mind no longer, say, is looking for satisfaction in the sense world. It's no longer looking for gratification or completion in the sense world, but rather sees the Dhamma itself, that ultimate reality of all things. That is the only place of completion. That's where wholeness and freedom, fulfillment, can be found. It's also interesting in this respect that the Buddha spoke about the stream entry as the change of lineage, the gotrabhu. So for some people that's a bit of a weird term. Change of lineage, what's that about? Well, part of the insight of stream entry is letting go of self-view. I am the body, I am the personality, sakkaya ditti. So that the teachings on not self, like I was describing about the Buddha's teaching to Nakulapita, these reflections, the body is not self, feelings are not self, perceptions are not self, mental formations are not self, consciousness is not self. This is not who and what we are. This is not mine, ne tang mama, ne sohamasmi, this is not what I am, ne name so me ata, this is not myself, this is not a real self. So, if the body is not self, then the fact that your biological parents, like my parents were Tom Horner and Pat Horner, those are my biological parents, Tom and Pat. My mother's birth name was Goldsmith, Pat Goldsmith, and then my father, Tom Horner. So my body came from Pat Goldsmith and Tom Horner, but if the body is not self, then if that's realized, rather than it's recognized that the lineage is changing, rather than from a biological lineage to the lineage of the Dhamma, born of the Dhamma, Dhammajati. So that is the change of lineage, is seeing that the origin of kind of what we are, quote unquote, is Dhamma itself. So that's the change of lineage, is seeing that, yeah, as long as there's attachment to the personality, to the body, to our life story, then our biological parents and grandparents and so forth are where we have come from. But if the view changes, if there's a letting go of that identification, that grasping, then it's recognized that the Dhamma is the source of reality. And so we use the word Dhammajati, born of the Dhamma. Also, it's interesting, in the Thai language, the word for nature, or natural, tamachat, comes from the Pali Dhammajati, born of the Dhamma. So I hope these reflections are useful, but I particularly encourage that going to look at that teaching, the dialogue between the Buddha and Ananda, the spiritual life is spiritual friendship is not half of the holy life, it's the whole of the holy life. And to look at the second part of that, and to see that even though we might say cherish companionship and feel a lack of that, you can't be separate from the Dhamma. That's the ultimate companionship, is the fabric of reality. That can't go anywhere else. That's the fabric of what is, if you like, and so that's always present. So rather than, say, looking for completion or refuge in that human companionship, that to be looking more deeply, to looking more sort of profoundly within, to use the meditation to the degree possible to look within, to develop that insight, and to recognize that, that even though this mind, this body might seem like a person, that I often say, that which knows the person isn't a person. Yeah, the mind is Dhamma, it's not a person. That we, when we look at our mind, we look at our memories or our thoughts or our emotions or our attitudes, feeling agitated, feeling sleepy, and say, "Oh, I'm sleepy. I'm remembering, or I want to." And so we look at the mind with all these personal qualities. But when we develop vipassana, that quality of insight, then that knowing, that awake, aware quality of the heart is being freed from its habitual attachments and identifications. And so in that respect, that can be recognized directly, known directly, that that which knows the person isn't a person. It's awake, it's aware, it knows. Even to call it an it is kind of not quite it, if you get my meaning. That quality of knowing is, I would say, is that the activity of Dhamma itself. It's like the Buddha arising from the Dhamma, the Buddha as the awake, aware quality that arises from the Dhamma. There's an attribute of Dhamma itself. So that which knows the person isn't a person. The mind is Dhamma, it's not a person. It knows the personal, it knows the body or the personality or the voice or the story, the kind of name and the memories. It's knowing all of those coming and going, but it is not those. That's like that teaching of the Buddha on not self. His advice to Nakula Pitta is, that if there is an embodying of that quality of knowing, then knowing an old body, then that which knows the old body and knows chronic pain is not pain. That knowing is free from identification with it. The body is still there, the life is still there, the sounds of my words are still here. But that which knows the sounds of these words is not a sound. That which knows this moment is not a person. And that might just be an idea or some words that are heard right now, but I would encourage really taking that to heart, to feel that, and to know that directly, and to contemplate that in the practice. That which knows this person is not a person. The mind is Dhamma, it's not a person. But to grab hold of that, to identify, I'm the Dhamma, that's what I am, that's the real me. That's just another thought. It's not a concept to grab hold of or an idea, but rather a direct realization, a direct embodying of Dhamma itself. And that is the most, I would say, the ultimate companionship. So, dear Ajahn Amaro, when I witness an injustice or a misbehavior being done by somebody else, and it seems clear that it would be suitable to speak up and take action, I find it difficult to stay internally in peace and not experience a sense of urgency, even anger or indignation. But when I see others who don't seem to care about the issue and just let things follow their own course, that doesn't seem to be right either. Would you please advise on how to be able to care and to take action when needed, but maintain the heart at peace and not feed the kilesas? Thank you. So, good question. Again, this is a very frequently asked question. I'm always quoting Hamlet's "To be or not to be" soliloquy in this respect, which I know the language is a bit weird for people for whom English is not their first language, but even if English is your first language, it's still a bit weird. So this is a famous soliloquy where Hamlet, in Shakespeare's play Hamlet, he's talking about whether he should take action or whether he should be passive. And the issue is that his uncle, whose name was Claudius, I think, has murdered his Hamlet's father, King Hamlet Senior. Hamlet Junior has had this visitation by his father as a ghost, has come to him and told him that his brother Claudius had killed him. And then not only that, but Claudius has now married the King Hamlet's widow. So Hamlet Junior's mother has now been married by his uncle. So he's got inside knowledge from this visitation that this has happened. And he's trying to decide what to do. So that the words of the soliloquy begin, to be or not to be, that is the question. Whether it is nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles and by opposing end them. But to translate that into understandable English, it's like, should I do or not do? Should I take action or should I be passive? What's the right thing to do? Should I suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune? Should I just be passive, just let things happen and not take action, just sort of switch off and not get involved? Or should I take arms against a sea of trouble? Should I actually step up and accuse my uncle of what he's done and take action and meet the situation head on in that way? Take arms against a sea of troubles, and by opposing those troubles, bring them to an end. So that's his conundrum. And so I think describes this very well, getting a sense of urgency, even angry and indignant, or should I just let things follow their own course? So I think that Shakespeare seems to have been an extremely insightful person, and that I think the point of Hamlet's dilemma, literally sort of being out on two wings, is that we might feel that kind of doubt, should I do or not do? But and perhaps Shakespeare really understood the middle way, but I feel it's also expressing what we understand as the middle way, as the solution to that particular dilemma, that puzzle. Because it's not a matter of being passive in the face of the way things are, or contending against the way things are, but rather working mindfully with the way things are. That's, I would suggest, in a short version, is the middle way. But because to either to take action and oppose, to contend against the way things are, is coming from a place of self-view and reactivity, or just switching off and going numb is again based on self-view. So one is the switching off is the vibhava tanha, the desire to not feel, to not be, to be annihilated. And then the bhava tanha is the desire to become, to get, to do. But both of those the Buddha names as a cause of dukkha. They're both bhava tanha, the desire to become, vibhava tanha, the desire to annihilate, or to not be, to not exist. Both of those are direct causes of suffering. So the middle way is the alternative. It's the appreciating the way things are. You're not just switching off. There's an opening of the heart to the way things are, and then through that openness and attunement, then letting action and speech, doing and not doing, be guided by mindfulness and wisdom, that attuning of the heart to the present moment, and then being, say, motivated by what's going to be of the greatest benefit, then being guided moment by moment by what is helpful, what's going to be, say, suitable. And so that might not sound like much of a formula, but that's how I operate here, living my life at Amaravati, and being in the role of a Buddhist monk, that you see those tendencies or urges to just sort of switch off and disconnect and not feel, or to sort of jump in and try to fix things, or feel, you've got to change this person or make that happen or stop making that stop happening. And so whenever the mind is in the kind of, I've got to make this happen, or I just don't want to know about it, then both of those very visibly, tangibly lead to more suffering. So, but then to say, okay, I recognize those tendencies, that's natural for us to feel that, but okay, what's really happening here? To sort of stop, be still, open the heart, okay, what's going on? How is this? What's really happening here? And what can be done? So there's a kind of deliberate letting go of those tendencies to go out into those two extremes, and then being still, opening the attention to the situation to the greatest degree possible, and then drawing upon wisdom, drawing upon that sort of the intuitive wisdom of the heart. And that the goodness of the heart, that guna dhamma, that quality of nobility, of respectfulness, of well-wishing. Okay, what's going to be of the greatest benefit here? And then just opening the heart to the situation and seeing what arises. And what arises might be, I haven't got a clue. This is really foggy. I can't see a way forward at all. But at least you know it's really foggy, and no way forward is immediately visible. But that can also be a helpful thing in and of itself. Another teaching that is useful in this respect about being helpful or what to do with situations. And it's also related to the area of social action and compassionate activity. As another of the suttas in the connected discourses, it's called the Bamboo Acrobats, the Siddhaka Sutta, and it starts off with the Buddha talking about this two street acrobats. It seems to be a father and a young daughter, and they are bamboo acrobats. And it seems like the father had a street performance they used to do. The father had a bamboo pole, and the little daughter would climb up the pole and do various acrobatic tricks. And so the Buddha describes this dialogue that happened between the parent and the child. And the little girl's name was Frying Pan. Why she was called Frying Pan is not written. Frying Pan. How she got the nickname Frying Pan is no... Yes, a very strange name to have. But Medhakalika is her name. It's Frying Pan. So he said. So the Buddha says, so the father said to the daughter, I'll look out for you and you look out for me, and that's the way you'll be able to climb up the pole, perform your tricks, come down safely from the pole, and we'll get a good fee from the crowd. And then the little Frying Pan says, no, that's not the way it is. I'll look out for myself, you look out for yourself. That's the way I'll climb the pole, do my tricks, do a good performance, come down safely from the pole, and we'll get a good fee from the crowd. And the Buddha then says it was the child was correct, the father was incorrect, that it's the best way to go about things is that by helping yourself, looking out for yourself, that's how you bring about the best result. I said, how do you do that? How do you most effectively help yourself? He says, by practicing the four foundations of mindfulness, the four satipatthanas. That's how we most directly help yourself. And by helping ourselves, then we help others. So he puts that in the first place. He said, but also, by helping others, you also help yourself. So it doesn't, like with the teaching on spiritual friendship, there's an appendix. You know, you have the first teaching and then you have a follow-up. Because of the follow-up, the Buddha says, yes, but also by helping others, you also help yourself. So it's most important to look out for your own actions, but also if you are looking out for others, you are helping others, then that also benefits you. And he said that the way that you are benefited in the effort, making the effort, putting time and energy into helping others, then you benefit yourself as well, because you develop harmlessness, avihingsa, patience, kantiya, loving kindness, metataya, and sympathy, anudayataya is sympathy. So that those qualities, if you're given to helping others, and particularly during this the COVID-19 pandemic, there's a huge amount of caring and effort, and people putting extraordinary amounts of time and energy and their own resources, laying their lives on the line, and many people having lost their lives, given their lives to the cause of helping others, that along the way they have been developed through that effort to help, to serve, and to look after the well-being of others. They've been developing patience, loving kindness, harmlessness, and sympathy. So that I feel that also in terms of what to do about situations, then those two standards, first of all, practice the four foundations of mindfulness yourself, establish mindfulness of the body, feelings, mental states, and of Dhamma, establish the four foundations of mindfulness yourself, so that you're relating to the mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of feelings, mindfulness of mind states, and mindfulness of things working according to the laws of Dhamma. That is the I'd say the primary resource or direction, but also when you're, say, coming from that basis of mindfulness and attunement, if you're then looking to make input and to help others, then that's coming from a skillful place. So the next one. Dear Ajahn, what action can one take to protect oneself from interference of invisible beings besides chanting protective suttas? Thank you. I'm not sure if by invisible beings you mean the coronavirus. Probably means more like ghosts and spirits and such like, but I think the coronavirus, well, it's coronavirus, if you put it under a microscope, you can see it, so it's not completely invisible. But yeah, there's I personally have no experience of meeting invisible beings. I have no problem with the idea that beings exist in different planes of existence that are not visible to the average human senses. I've never had any kind of philosophical objection to different realms, different beings, different entities occupying the multiverse or different dimensions of existence. So I've always been quite comfortable with that idea, but I've never met a single ghost or a deva or a fairy or a yucca. So I can't speak from direct experience. But if you read Lumpa Cha's biography, then he does talk about this this kind of thing once or twice along the way. And so he had a lot of experience and faith that it was really sila, the keeping of the precepts, that is the most powerful protection. That if you are concerned about being, say, given a bad time by malevolent entities, whether they are visible or invisible, then along with the protective verses you might recite, like the names of the 28 Buddhas, or the chanting that we've been doing, the Yankinchi Witang Sutta, that Ratana Sutta we've been chanting, that the Buddha gave when there was an epidemic, and there was also a lot of demonic attacks in Visali. That Lumpa Cha said, really, the from his experience, the keeping of the precepts, that's the most powerful protection, and that that was what he really encouraged. So whether there is visible beings or invisible beings, I would say that's along with chanting and taking refuge, that the way that the taking refuge in Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha is most genuinely and actively embodied is by us keeping the precepts. And when the people would come to Lumpur Cha, when I was there in the late 70s in Thailand and around Lumpur Cha, sometimes there was a lot of communist insurgency and kind of border wars, and there was a lot of military in the area. And the northeast of Thailand is kind of wild country, fairly lawless. So that there was a lot of social disturbance, and then the communist insurgency from the 70s was, there was a lot of pockets of that around the area. And so there was often soldiers would come to Lumpur Cha and ask for blessings because they were being sent off to some particularly dangerous area of the border regions between Ubon and Laos, so they'd often come to to the Cambodian border. Ubon borders both with Laos and Cambodia, so the soldiers would come to ask Ajahn Chah for protection. They'd have amulets, and Lumpur Cha was not a big amulet fan. He would never give out any to other people, but sometimes if people, they'd have their own amulets and say, please could you protect these, or give a blessing so that I won't get shot, or I'll be safe. So usually, and I've got vague distant memories, this was all 40 years ago, but I got vague memories of groups of soldiers coming along, and Lumpur Cha, he'd take the amulets and then he'd give them like an hour-long Dhamma talk about keeping the sila, and saying, really, you know, this is what's going to protect you in the battleground. This is going to protect you in your life far more than any kind of magical powers. But he eventually, after giving him a good rousing Dhamma talk for an hour or so, then he'd pick up the amulets and then do some chanting over them. Then he'd sort of say, okay, there you go. And then, again, I can't remember whether this is me remembering or whether I heard the story, but also I couldn't understand Thai, so I wouldn't have heard it directly, but it would have been with one of the other Westerners who was there. That at least on a couple of occasions, Lumpur Cha handed them back and said, yeah, they'll only work if you keep the five precepts. If you stop keeping the precepts, then they won't protect you anymore. So whether he did actually say, we wouldn't have said it in English, but whether he actually did say that or that's just anecdotal, I don't know. But I can easily imagine him having said that, that that'll protect you, but if you stop keeping the precepts, then you're on your own. And as a way of both sort of playfully, but also actually helping them to sincerely keep the precepts to the best of their ability. So a couple more. Dear Ajahn, different schools and traditions, and even monasteries within the same tradition, have different ways, more or less strict, of following the Vinaya rules. What is the best way to relate to this without judgment? How to distinguish, quote, unattachment to rites and rituals, unquote, from complacency and cherry-picking? Good question. Well, I don't think there's any substitute for personal experience, because you might hear about a place or you hear someone's someone praised highly, but you really have to go to some place and actually meet the people, to meet the kind of the person who's leading it, the way they operate, and to test things out, because it's easy to be make rapid judgments from a superficial perception, so that draw close and watch. As the Buddha said, when someone asked, yeah, how can you tell whether somebody's enlightened or not? And the Buddha said, you have to live with someone for an extended period of time to really know where they are at. You can't just make a superficial judgment accurately, but you need to be with someone for an extended period of time and to see how they operate to get an accurate reading. Also, the issue of cherry picking, or if you've got a fixed idea of what a great teacher or is supposed to be like, or how things should be, then you can have a long, long search. And I'm reminded again of Lumpur Cha, when somebody came to him who'd been visiting all of the great gurus. This was in the 70s, so been through India, had been to see Neem Karoli Baba, been to see, you know, Sri to the Sri Ramana Ashram, been to visit Swami Muktananda and the great Ajahns of Burma and Thailand, and having visited all these great gurus and teachers, and you know, everything was everyone had something wrong with them. Everything was not quite right, not quite perfect, and. And Ajahn Sumedho was a young monk at that time, was translating for Lumpur Cha, and Lumpur Cha made the comment, you're looking for a turtle with a moustache. And a young Lumpur Sumedho had never heard this expression before. Dao gap nuot. What? And he said, like a turtle, like with a shell and a moustache? And Lumpur said, that's right. He says, you're looking for a turtle with a moustache. I'm not sure what that means. And Lumpur had a big grin on his face and said, you're looking for a turtle with a moustache. And this inquirer said, well, what do you mean? How dare you? What are you talking about? He said, you're looking for something that doesn't exist. There are no turtles with moustaches. They don't exist. What you're looking for is a teacher who will always please you and will fit every criteria of your preferences and your expectations. No such person can exist. You're looking for something that it cannot be in this world, that some teacher that would always please you. So he said, if you want to, you can stay here, and I'll teach you if you like, but I can guarantee there'll be things that I do or say that will disappoint you, that will upset you, and that's how it always is. It's necessarily this way, just as you know, I'm sure things that I say and do have managed to upset numbers of people, probably everybody here at some point, saying, how can he say that? Or, he just did what? I'm not reading anyone's mind, but that's how it is. That's the way nature works. So Lumpur said, I can teach you, and I'm sure I'll disappoint you from time to time, but I'll also teach you, if you're ready to learn, what the cause of your suffering is and how to get beyond it. But if you don't want to listen, if you don't want to learn, then please have a good life. But you're welcome to follow your own path. So that in that respect, I feel that finding out from your direct experience, seeing what the results are. Not taking things from on a superficial level, and to see the results of your own attachment. If you sometimes our own kind of guna dhamma, that our own good heart, can get taken over by the forces of Mara, and that our own rightness becomes the most important thing in the world. This is right. This is good. It shouldn't be this way. It should be that way. And I've known instances in the past where someone who had very, very kind of high aspirations, very high ideals, very pure-hearted, they were that kind of goodness or that love of the good got totally co-opted by the critical mind, and so that it was never, the people around him were never quite good enough, never quite pure enough, never quite strict enough, never quite right enough. And I've known this two or three times over the years. It's quite tragic because there's this enormous sincerity, but it just goes. It gets to a point where even the Buddha is not Buddhist enough. It's like this. It's really. I'm not kidding. It's like someone so desperate to try and find the pure Theravada that kind of even the Buddha is not Buddhist enough. And unfortunately, that is not a joke. That's the way it goes sometimes, or that you can't live with anyone because there's always the mind focusing on the wrongness or the disappointing qualities of this or that person. So I think it's a good part of the question, the complacency and cherry picking that our own, say, attachment to how it should be, our own idealism, to be careful of that not taking over, and our own happiness, our own goodness getting really infected with that terrible virus of avijja, of ignorance, that is sort of taken over by ignorance and conceit, so that then we can never find happiness, we can never find freedom, because the mind can't see beyond that. It's wrong, it shouldn't be that way, that's bad and wrong, and can no longer see the Dhamma because of attachment to the idea of the Dhamma. Ajahn, if one could choose between putting her mind into one of these states before the moment of death, which is the most superior? Well, whoever's asking this question, I sincerely hope that you have a choice. Neatly laid out, items 1, 2, 3, and 4. Well, may your life continue to be so orderly. I like lists myself. I number things, and I can empathize with this inquiry. So the first one, metta. Second one, first jhana. Third one, anicca sanya, the perception of impermanence. And fourth, awareness itself. Well, if it comes about, and if you've got enough time in your 3 seconds as death approaches to sort out how many items there are on the list, I would, and if there is a capacity to choose, I would choose number 4, awareness itself, but not the idea of awareness itself, because that's just an idea. Awareness itself is not awareness, there's a word, it's 2 words. Yeah, awareness itself is not. Those are 2 words. It's the actual quality of awareness itself is the thing to aim for, if thing is the right word. Also, in that advice that the Buddha gave to Mahanama, Mahanama asks, who's a cousin of the Buddha, or relative of the Buddha, asking for what to say to people when they're on their deathbed. As the leader of the Sakyans, he would occasionally be invited to the bedside of people in their last hours. And he said, what advice should I give them? So, as I've mentioned a week or two ago, the Buddha gave a sequence of different kinds of advice on how to let go of things. But at the end of the whole string of advice, he says, well, rather than fixing the mind on being reborn in the Brahma world, better than that is to focus the attention, focus the mind on Sakaya Nirodha. So Sakaya, just like in Sakaya Ditti, Sa means true or real, Kaya means the body, or the person, Ditti is view, and this Sakaya Nirodha, so the cessation of identity, the cessation of the real person. And he said, and this is one of the few instances where the Buddha speaks about a lay person realizing complete enlightenment. And he says, and one who focuses the mind on Sakaya Nirodha, there is no difference between the state of their liberation and that of a monk who's been an arahant for 100 years. There's no difference between the two. So that's quite an emphatic statement of the Buddha. So even rather than awareness itself, Sakaya Nirodha, if you can remember that, Sakaya, the cessation of identity, not being any person, not being an I, to let go of I, and again, not just the idea of it, but the actuality of it, that is the what the Buddha recommended as the thing to bring the attention to at that last moment. Last question. Dear Ajahn Amaro, firstly, I'd like to thank you and all the others involved in making these online Dhamma talks. So, gratitude to the IT video team. Making these online Dhamma talks, they are incredibly helpful. I hope these can continue even if the lockdown situation is lifted. Don't hold your breath. Possibly. The future is uncertain. But it's also a lot of work to make it happen all the time. And visiting the monastery, when monasteries are visitable, is also highly desirable and beneficial. I have a simple question. Coming from a very educated family background, I find myself entangled in very high expectations, especially from my parents. Recently, they are all focused on when I'm getting married, and quite keen on me being married before a certain age, and they keep asking me what I'm going to do. I've told them many times that I'm not ready nor have any intention of getting married now or in the near future, and to not keep bugging me about it all the time. But they keep getting distressed about it to the point I feel that they might have a health issue or something because of that. Most often when they talk with me, they keep bringing up the issue and talk about it for hours, and it just burns me out. Any suggestions on how one might handle this kind of issue without hurting other people's feelings or getting myself tied up into something I don't like just to make them happy? Well, you are asking a Buddhist monk this question. It's kind of likely the sort of answer you're going to get. Maybe just to briefly... So when I first walked into Wat Pananachat, I'd never read a Buddhist book. I'd had very minimal contact with any kind of Buddhism. But extremely quickly, I realized this is exactly what I'd been looking for in terms of a spiritual life and training and such. And I had a very strong intuitive sense was this was a perfect fit, even though I was more of a hippie anarchist type and didn't like rules or organized religion. It was the shoe really fit. And so within about 3 weeks of being there at Wat Pananachat, I had this sense, I'm going to be here for a long time. This really feels like a lifetime commitment. I'm saying that from 40 years later, so it seemed to have been a reliable intuition. Anyway, so at that point, about 3 weeks into the monastery life, and I was sweeping up the path in front of my kuti, and it suddenly hit me that I love my family. My parents have been very, very good to me. They'd worked really hard. They were fortunately, both my parents were total academic failures, so that they didn't have any kind of expectations of what us children might do, which is, I think, a blessing in its own right. But they did have certain expectations, and so that me feeling like I really want to be a Buddhist monk and do this for the rest of my life, it suddenly hit me that my parents are this very conservative, middle-class, rural English couple, and there's absolutely no way they could ever understand this. This is like so alien, it's so weird, and it was just so impossible for them to digest this. So the thought crossed my mind, maybe I should just go back to England, yeah, find a nice woman to get married to and have children and bring them up with roses around the door and can have teach them to have nice table manners and to write good thank you letters for their birthday presents to Granny and Grandpa. And maybe that would be the thing to do. And this all sort of happened in a kind of brief flash, the whole picture of maybe I should just do that and have curly-headed children running around in the garden. And I was a curly-headed kid running around the garden. And then it suddenly hit me. It was almost like hearing a voice in my ear, like said, that would be a cruelty to yourself and a cruelty to your family. And you can't live your life trying to fulfill other people's expectations of you. It's an unkindness to them and it's an unkindness to you. And again, it was all there in a flash. What would that be like if I did marry someone that was a parent to some children and I really didn't want to be there? My heart wasn't in it. What that would be like? And it was this weird sort of, it was all there in this moment. It's like, that would be so horrible. How can I do that to anybody? That would be such a cruel thing to do, that I don't really want to be your parent. I don't really want to be married to you. I don't really want any of this. And just sort of performing that role just for the sake of. And then also part of it was that you can't really please other people. And again, it was all in this one little moment. It came clear that even if you sent the kids to the right schools and they spoke with nice, proper public school English accents, had good table manners, still something would be wrong. They'd have the wrong kind of haircut, or they'd be gay, or they'd kind of go off to join the Communist Party, or something would be upsetting. And it was really clear that only we ourselves can make ourselves happy. Like, I can't make you happy. You can make yourself happy. I can't make you happy. That's exactly the same for everyone here at Amravati. Even if someone here at Amravati thinks, it's your job to make me happy, Ajahn, I'm not happy, and so you're not doing your job right. Yeah, try harder, and then I'll be happy. I say, well, good luck with that. Seriously, yeah, that I won't pick that up, because I realize I can't make anybody happy. I can help people have the tools to make themselves happy, but I can't make anybody else happy. And the Buddha said exactly the same thing. I found out later, I mean, this is all before I'd even read or heard many teachings at all. The Buddha said, yeah, the Tathagata only points the way. He can't make people make the journey. He can't make the journey for them. He can point the way, but that's it. So that, in terms of this question, I would say that, again, I don't want to cause too many rifts in your family and say, Ajahn Amro said, you know, I've got a recording of it, you know, I'll play it back to you, yeah, I'll prove it. So please don't do that. Well, what you do is your own business. But I would say, you know, you can't make your parents happy. They might say, if you got married, you'd make us happy. If you stay unmarried, we'll be unhappy and we'll never forgive you. With all due respect, I'd say that's their business. They might say that, and they might think it's true, but I would say it's not true. That it's that even if someone says, I'm unhappy and it's your fault, that it's like, well, yes and no. That it's really up to each one of us in this moment whether we are able to be at peace, be able to be kind of happy in the most profound sense with the way things are. I've known people literally on their deathbed. I met a guy in hospital in Cambridge, Addenbrooke's Hospital, who was paralyzed from the neck down. He had motor neuron disease. He was one of the happiest people I ever met. His eyes were just alive with just this joy. And he was weeks away from dying. He died about 6 weeks later. And he was one of the most joyful people. He couldn't speak anymore. He had to talk through a knitting needle stuck in a champagne cork in his teeth. And he could move his neck and he could point out letters on a letterboard. He couldn't speak anymore. But he was extraordinarily happy, joyful. And his life was ebbing away. He had nothing. He couldn't move, couldn't speak. He was absolutely fine. I'm not praising sickness or making excuses for not making a difference in the world when we can. But you know, that I feel is a good example, that it's entirely up to us what we make of this. And again, as I was saying earlier today, some people have an extraordinarily privileged situation. All the power in the world, you know, the money and position and the reputation in society, and they're absolutely miserable. You know, they have everything that could be wished for, and they're completely miserable because of what their mind is doing, and so how the mind handles the moment by moment experience. So, in terms of your question, I would say to if you want to follow my example, not into the monastery necessarily, but to say just trust your own intuition and to say, well, I don't want to make my parents unhappy, but if what I do causes them unhappiness, that's an unfortunate side effect, but I'm not doing it in order to make them unhappy. And that's exactly what I reflected on all those years ago when I went to Wat Nanachar. I said, well, if I do become a Buddhist monk and my parents are unhappy, I'm not doing it maliciously. I'm not doing it to make them unhappy. It's not my intention. My intention is to follow my heart and to do what seems to be the most appropriate and perfect thing to do with this life. If they're unhappy with that, then that's their business. And so I decided to trust that. And so, to be honest, for the first 15 years, it was pretty difficult for them. But then, I was very firm in my commitment, and I didn't try and convert them to Buddhism. But after about 15 years, when I was a Buddhist monk, neither of my sisters were married. They were both career women. And the parents' ideas of, you know, the family name carrying on or grandchildren were like, okay, well, none of that's going to happen. Something in them shifted. And they said, well, actually, they're all the children, they are fulfilled in their own fields of work and activity. So just change our ideas. And so that was unexpected, but quite a delightful surprise. So I'd been in the monastery about 15 years by then. Both my sisters were around 40-ish by then. But our parents changed. The attitude shifted, and they were able to celebrate us for what we are. And one of my sisters did get married shortly after. But that wasn't really the point. It was really that the parental attitude shifted. So I would encourage you to say that, follow your intuition, to make your own. I don't make choices for other people. I say, draw upon your own intuition, follow your own intuition, let that guide you, and to see that trying to find happiness through fulfilling other people's expectations of you is never really going to work. I would suggest that's never going to work. It never really comes to any kind of completion. And so that, just to take that to heart, and then to trust that, and to, even if the members of the family get upset or are irritated and say, you know, if you love me, you do this. Say, well, thank you for sharing. You know, bearing in mind also the Buddha's father, King Suddhodana, he was unhappy even after his son was the Buddha. You know, in the commentaries, later material, they talk about King Suddhodana becoming a stream enterer, becoming the Buddha's disciple. Even some of them talk about him becoming an arahant. In the canon, the Pali canon, there is no place where King Suddhodana says, please take me as a lay disciple who's gone for refuge to you for life. He never takes the refuges. He never declares faith in his son's teaching. Not once. Some people in the Theravada world are surprised that, and they hear these words, and they go, wait a minute, I know. But you can't find a single place in the Pali canon where King Suddhodana expresses pleasure in his son's life as a Buddha. Even though he's a fully enlightened Buddha, King Suddhodana could not appreciate his son's spiritual maturity. And so sometimes it's like that dad is determined, or mum, to hang on to their perspective. And so I feel that's, in a way, that's quite an amazing and good example that, you know, your child is a Buddha, is a totally enlightened being, and is this great blessing to the world, and still feeling like, should be running the kingdom. You know, I told him, it's not like, I don't like it, I don't approve, no, don't like it. And, you know, I'm kind of joking, kind of not joking. But I feel that's even the Buddha couldn't please his father. Yeah, he's a fully enlightened Buddha, the most accomplished teacher. He was not able to teach to the extent of his father having faith in him, to taking refuge in him, or to expressing delight in his teachings. He's tolerant, but he doesn't delight in it. And so I feel that's a good example. So don't feel that if you do the right thing, if you follow your heart, that your parents will come around. Maybe they won't, but I think what you can trust is your own good intentions and your own well-wishing, and then it's up to each individual what they do with it. So I think that's plenty for today. I offer these thoughts for consideration.